You can't come here, not in the light of day. Somebody has got plans for you. Starve at home or hide away. Will we open up the borders? Tear down the prison walls. Declare that no one is illegal. Watch the giant as it falls.
This is a Building Bridges, your community and labor report special. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. The Reverend James Lawson was a principal advisor to the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. from the Montgomery bus boycotts through the Freedom Rise, which began in 1961, and throughout the Civil Rights Movement of the 1960s. In the 1970s, he relocated to Los Angeles and became involved in the movement for labor rights, which increasingly involved the immigrant workers in that area. We spoke to the Reverend James Lawson recently about the project he is now working on, the Immigrant Worker Freedom Ride.
The world's getting smaller. Hear the drowning child crying. Why are the fences growing taller? Some whisper in the shadows, while others count the dollars.
Reverend Lawson, there have been many commemorative services and recognition of the historic March on Washington in 1963, led by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. Would you say these many years later that the agenda of economic, social, and political justice for people of African ancestry has been realized?
No, period. Has not been realized. While there have been certain kinds of gains and benefits and progress made towards the goal of equality, liberty, and justice for all, the goal is as far away as the distance from which we have come towards progress. As Ruth Bader in the Supreme Court decision just recently rendered over the issue of affirmative action at University of Michigan indicated, we have a long racist history of discrimination against people because of the color of their skin, because of slavery, because of the Jim Crow laws and all, and that therefore racism is still epidemic in our society. And you have to use race in order to eradicate the racism. You have to take the issue of what is discrimination and racism, and you have to nevertheless recognize it and use it to eradicate it. Racism is more pervasive today than it has ever been in my own lifetime.
I'd like to link that in also to the issues about immigrant rights that are coming up.
Well, that, of course, is just one part of the issue still. The fact that we're talking about now 8+ million immigrants in the last 10 or 15 years, the vast majority of whom are people of color, not the traditional immigrants from Europe, people from Africa, Asia, and Latin America, that makes the anti-immigrant spirit even more venomous in its hostility. So that, again, is one of the signs of the racism in our society.
We have a Republican administration where the Justice Department recently filed briefs in opposition to the continuation of affirmative action. How do you look at the policies that emanate from this national government at this point in time? Maybe referencing it back again to that striking, important march in 1963.
Well, of course, that march as a part of the movement of the 60s did engender great hostility from people like Strom Thurmond and Trent Lott, who were all contemporaries, and Gerald Farwell of the church and all. That resistance solidified itself back in the 60s, and they've continued persistently to oppose any march towards economic justice on the part of poor people, people of color. So I maintain that what we call a Republican administration right now is really but a Dixiecrat administration. The Republicans having used the Southern strategy to put racism into code language so that they could persuade the white South that the Republican Party would hold the line against civil rights and against the emergence of black people into equality. I tend to call George Bush a Dixiecrat, and combine then with the corporate takeover of governance at both local and national levels, you have a particularly virulent form of tyranny that threatens access to liberty and justice and all. I don't pretend that the administration is a Republican administration. I insist that it is a Dixiecrat administration in the name of conservatism come to power.
How does this tie into labor unions? I know that you've been active in the
yes.
labor movement in Los
oh,
Angeles.
Oh, absolutely. Well, remember Walter Reuther and the UAW and a number of other international unions gave big impetus to the march. The march of 40 years ago had as its slogan about jobs and liberty and equality for all. So that was the major slogan, economic justice. Get on with the task of making America, America for everyone. Since that time, also, the anti-unionism of the South has become national policy and the business of large corporations across the board, breaking unions and then keeping jobs, low-paying jobs, has been a part of the style of what I tend to call the plantation capitalism of today. So the option we have, of course, is then that working people need to wake up, and we need unions to wake up and really put major money and human resources into organizing workers all over this country so that we can become a counterforce to the capitalism that George Bush represents.
In 1961, you were a coordinator of the civil rights era Freedom Rises.
Yeah.
Really creative tactic to begin to address and mm-hmm. break the back of segregation and really racial apartheid in the southern states.
Mm-hmm.
We are on the precipice of an immigrants' rights freedom ride, which will coalesce in New York on October 4th. And I wonder how you feel about utilizing the strategy and evolving out of this tremendous,
right.
important tactic of the African-American movement, which is now being employed to look at the rights of immigrants.
Yes. Well, the Freedom Ride in 1961 was an illustration of a nonviolent tactic that had been used in the 1830s, where people like Frederick Douglass, with white colleagues but free Negroes in Pennsylvania, New York, and New England, went on the trains and the carriages and with biracial groups to fight the segregating of the trains, the Jim Crow laws that had already begun in transportation. So I maintain that the Freedom Ride is one of the historic tactics used for the struggle. None of these tactics belong to any community. I would wish that all kinds of people would look at the nonviolent struggles of the 20th century and the 19th century and would learn from them and recognize that here is a powerful political tool and that it's the only tool that we have that can create a serious fight against some of these wrongs that are being again imposed in various ways upon the country. So I see this Freedom Ride 2000 as a continuation of the use of creative struggle for gaining access, for trying to dismantle some of the racism, and for dramatizing the issues and putting the issues on the minds of tens of thousands of people across the country.
And what are those issues that are involved with the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride?
Fairness. These are people who pay taxes, hardworking people. Some of them work at two and three jobs. They support the economy with billions of dollars of work, so they ought to be treated with a process whereby they can get the papers they want to be here without threat, whether to become a citizen or simply to get permanent residency, to get the red tape out of the way, and make it a process for people who are decent, hardworking family people. It is also an issue of racism in the sense that this bureaucracy that gets in the way of these immigrants, particularly at the same time, caters to certain selected groups. A Cuban can swim across the 90 miles to Florida, immediately be received and put into a process of naturalization. A Haitian running from far harsher, more tyrannical circumstances, is detained, put in the jail, held, and not allowed to even apply for the naturalization process. So some of the people on the buses are going to be Haitians from the Miami area, on one of the buses going north towards D.C. and New York. So those are some of the issues. And the fact that these are largely people of color that we're talking about, while they're from all over the world, the vast bulk of the ones who are catching the main push of opposition from the society and from the federal government are people of color. It's also a gender problem, because sizable numbers of women are involved in this. It's also a issue of living wages, because many of these workers, and I've met a number of them all across the country, in fact, many of these workers live in job situations where they must get only minimum wages, no benefits, and always with the employer thrusting at them the fact that you don't have the proper papers as a way of intimidation and harassment.
So would you say that you feel optimistic about replicating the Freedom Rides, as you pointed out, of the Douglas era, of the Civil Rights era, and now taking up the call to bring the new immigrant populations into the process of collectively seeking economic, social, political, and indeed human rights?
Yes, we who've been on the planning committee see ourselves precisely using the Freedom Ride as a way of putting the issue on the agendas of a lot of people. Some groups have pushed us that we should support certain legislation. We have said, no, the Freedom Ride is not going to get behind this bill or that bill. We instead want to raise the issues of fairness, the issues of dignity, the issues of the necessity of the nation putting this matter on its agenda and beginning to move to change it. We see the Freedom Ride as only like the Freedom Ride of 1961, which did dramatize the issue, put it on the front pages of the country. The reaction of the people who were hostile to us with burning the bus in Anniston, Alabama, just made that burning bus flash all around the world. After most of us got out of jail in 61, then there was determined work that went on behind the scenes that helped to speed up the process of pulling down the white-colored signs downtown places, in bus stations and train stations and airports and whatnot. That work, in a sense, began the dismantling of this visible apartheid system. So we see the Freedom Ride 2003 as the first step. What other steps need to be taken, we don't know yet, even from the point of view of our own agitation and planning. We see it as a first step, and immigrant groups that are supporting the ride and with whom we've had conversations already talking about this was a plus. There's been great enthusiasm about doing this, but they're already talking about what do we do next. We will ignite a movement one day in the 21st century that will continue the struggle of the 20s and 30s and the 40s and of the 50s and the 60s and the 70s into the 21st century, and we will prevail.
May we meet our sisters and our brothers, stand arm in arm there in the daylight, no longer fighting one another. Will we stand together, for therein lies our might? Will we understand these words? Workers of the world, unite. Will we open?
You've been listening to the Reverend James Lawson on civil rights, labor rights, and the Immigrant Worker Freedom Ride, which will cross the country this month, culminating in a mass rally in Flushing Meadows Park on Saturday, October 4th. You can learn more about the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride by going to the New York City Central Labor Council website at www.nycclc.org. That's www.nycclc.org. The Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride will be broadcast live over WBAI on Saturday, October 4th.
in El Salvador, FMLN member C. Shafiq Handel as the individual who best represents the party's commitment to constructing a new social and economic model based on justice and equality. Handel, whose political activities began in 1944 with a strike of fallen arms which overthrew the military dictatorship of the period, has been an organizer for more than five decades. During the Revolutionary War in the 1980s, he served as the FMLN's general command, both in El Salvador and in exile. He headed up the FMLN's negotiating committee that eventually won the 1992 peace accords. In 1997, Handel was elected to the Salvadorian Legislative Assembly, where he currently serves as the leader of the FMLN legislative bloc. Handel's presidential candidacy has already received the support of unions and popular organizations from across the Salvadoran social movement, and he enjoys 8-13% over the ruling party ARENA in opinion polls. Desperate to hold on to power, the ruling ARENA party has deployed a strategy of fear and violence, seeking to terrorize Salvadorans into staying home on Election Day in March. Building Bridges reporter Ken Nash spoke with Shafiq Handel, FMLN candidate for president of El Salvador, about economic policies of the U.S. towards El Salvador.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
This is also a period of time when people's attention is focused on the World Trade Agreement. It's also focused on the Central America Free Trade Agreement and the Latin America Trade Agreement. If you could comment on the issues of free trade as it affects El Salvador.
Nosotros estamos, y en particular yo mismo, estamos a favor de diversificar el comercio mundial y de conseguir términos equitativos que permitan a nuestros pueblos prosperar, desarrollarse. Ciertamente este no es el caso del TLC que está discutiéndose entre Centroamérica y los Estados Unidos. Y hay
we in our party and me
Salvador
personally
y en otros países
support
de
diversification and
Latina,
increase of
hay
trade,
tensión,
but we demand fair trade. We think that this is not the case of the CAFTA agreement in the terms that this agreement has been negotiated so far. We don't see evidence that this agreement will benefit our local producer or local farmers. We see this CAFTA agreement just one more step to the free trade agreement with the America. And we see that, in fact, this agreement will not promote fair trade. And to some extent, they even don't promote trade. For us, it's very difficult to accept such agreement when they will put a lot of strain in our local producer, particularly the farmers, the small and medium entrepreneurs, and our local producer. We support trade agreement if and always this agreement are in line with our independent way to develop our country. We want to strengthen trade and economic ties with the U.S. We recognize that the U.S. is our first trade partner in the world, and in the U.S. live almost 2 million Salvadorans. And we think that we should strengthen these ties, but in a way that reinforce our possibilities for authentic economic and social development.
Y además, nosotros estamos demandando en El Salvador, en la Asamblea Legislativa, yo soy diputado, hemos estado demandando que se negocie de cara al país, que los sectores que serán implicados o afectados por este tratado deben tener la posibilidad de intervenir en las negociaciones.
And on top of that, we and the most of the people demand open negotiation. So far, all these free trade negotiations are being conducted in kind of secrecy. Even the deputies in the National Assembly, we are not being informed about the contents of these negotiation rounds. We think that all the sectors that could be affected by the implication of CAFTA should have a voice in this discussion. In the case that the Congress in the U.S. and congressmen and congresswomen were not informed about the ongoing negotiation, they will simply not ratify, or they will simply not support this negotiation. That is not the case in the U.S., but it's the case in El Salvador, when the government remains very close to discuss with the political parties and with the different sectors about the implication and the real discussion in this negotiation. We think that if this agreement will destroy our agriculture, will destroy our small and medium enterprise, we will have an additional effect. More and more immigrants will try to come to the U.S. In the time when the U.S. immigration laws are getting tougher and tougher. So we think that the effects of this negotiation, if they are not conducted in a proper way, will ultimately affect even the U.S. Right now, more than 300 people from El Salvador are trying to escape daily El Salvador. So we can imagine how big will be the impact if our agriculture sector is destroyed by the CAFTA agreement.
I wanted to pick up on the question of immigration because that is entering the mainstream of discussion in the United States. There's going to be a big march and rally, in fact, in New York City on October 4th. How do you think the United States should reform its immigration procedure for Salvadoran and other immigrants?
Bueno, nosotros hace mucho tiempo venimos acompañando a nuestros compatriotas en Estados Unidos. A las organizaciones de nuestros compatriotas durante los años 80 fuimos nosotros los que contribuimos a que se organizaran.
Traditionally, we have been very sympathetic to our immigrant community here in the U.S. We have been supporting all their efforts to organize themselves, and we support their demand to get not only a temporary relief regarding the immigration status, we also support their demand to have a permanent and stable status. We support their demand for residency, but more than that, we want to go to the root of the problem, and the root of the problem is that there are no conditions in El Salvador for these families to stay and work there. So we want to create an environment in El Salvador in which Salvadorian people want to stay in El Salvador, to work there, to live there. We think that that is one of our goals in this visit, to explain to the Salvadorian community our electoral platform, our vision of the government, and our specific proposal on how to reestablish growth in El Salvador, in order to our families, our fellow citizens.
Este es un problema humanitario, que es un problema de derechos humanos, la desigualdad, la gran desventaja para la vida cotidiana en que se encuentran los inmigrantes aquí en este país. Claro, los Estados Unidos tienen su propia legislación, son soberanos para trazar sus políticas, pero nosotros quisiéramos que este punto fuera también parte de las negociaciones. Es un problema humano y es un problema que debe resolverse
immigration issue
cooperando.
Is a human right problem. Immigrants face very strong disadvantage being here in the USA. Of course, the U.S. government has all its right to enact immigration legislation here, but the thing is that we think that the U.S. government should increase their cooperation for development for El Salvador and for developing countries, and in that way the U.S. government will cooperate in establishing conditions in our countries to people stay there and work there and contribute to our social and economic development. We think that the U.S. has the possibility to cooperate in a larger way with our societies, and the immigration problem will be solved, but in a more comprehensive approach, working together with our governments, with our societies, in order to people staying there in their own countries. And that should be a process of negotiation between our countries, and in order to find the way to discuss the immigration problem as a part of bilateral or multilateral negotiation.
En lo que se refiere a los compatriotas salvadoreños que trabajan aquí, viven aquí en los Estados Unidos, nosotros los estamos acompañando también en otras demandas de ellos. Una es su ejercer su derecho a votar en las elecciones del Salvador, los que están aquí en el extranjero. Esa es una práctica universal. Ya hay países de Centroamérica en donde su...
Regarding the Salvadorian community living here in the U.S., we also support their demand for getting their political rights being respected. For example, their right to vote here in the U.S. in order to elect public officials in El Salvador. We know that some countries allow their citizens to vote here, or in general to vote in being abroad. And that's not the case for El Salvador. And we support their demand to vote. And we also support their demand to the air ticket fares being reduced. You know, it's weird, but with the cost of one air ticket from New York or Washington to El Salvador, you can travel to Europe. And so you cannot see the logic of this, because there's a problem of competition in this case, and we think that the airfares could and should be reduced. We also are supporting the demand of our fellow citizens to reduce the cost of sending remittances to the families in El Salvador. A big percent of the money they are sending to the families is being called by the banks or by those companies who work in this money. And we also are trying to persuade the Mexican government in order to pay more respect for the human rights of the immigrants who have to travel through Mexico in their way to the U.S. and they have been abused. Many of them are being put in jail. Many of them have been even murdered in Mexico. So that's another point we are dealing, and we are decide to discuss this point with the Mexican government.
Thank you very much, and I hope that the next time I speak to you will be at the Presidential Palace in El Salvador and you will be president.
Muy bien, está invitado.
So you are invited to that moment.
Okay, thank you so much.
You've been listening to Building Bridges reporter Ken Nash in an interview with Shafiq Handel, FMLN candidate for president of El Salvador. This has been a Building Bridges, your community and labor report special.